Order. Apologize for being a couple of minutes late after yelling at some of my poor colleagues yesterday about being late. We will start off by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 527. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senate Bill 527 imposes a mandatory minimum term of 400 months of imprisonment for a person's third conviction of specified crimes. It declares an emergency that's effective upon passage.
Call Amy Elkanich and Kevin Neely.
Could you just tell us what the testimony is going to be? Maybe I'll be surprised, Madam Chair.
I think this could be very short.
Madam Chair, well, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Twice in 2 days, I've been up here on the same side as Ms. Elkanich. I'm pleased to say Senate Bill 527 is a three-strikes bill. The district attorneys do not support Senate Bill 527. Measure 11 works. This bill doesn't really fit into the standard that the district attorneys generally like, which is proportionality. The sentences here, you may have a 400-month sentence for a robbery one. The same sentence would then apply also to a murder one. Measure 11 adheres to those ideals of proportionality. Consequently, in this instance, the district attorneys do not support Senate Bill 527.
Thank you, Ms. Elkanich.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Elkanich with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And again, I do find myself in good company. Our organization does not support clearly 527. Although we're not willing to make the same statement about Measure 11 that Mr. Neely did, we believe that it is disproportionate. We believe it doesn't fit into the sentencing structure that's set up currently, and we believe it's not fiscally sound. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair, quit bringing these two up together. It confuses me.
Duly noted, Senator Cruz. Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 527.
Tough duty.
And open a work session for possible measure introduction. Senator Beyer, we have a measure to be introduced. It's a priority bill for Senator Brown.
Madam Chair, I move LC 3820 be introduced as a Judiciary Committee bill.
Senator Beyer has moved LC 3820 be introduced as a Judiciary Committee bill. We haven't had a bill introduction for quite some time, and just to remind people that these are done without regard to the merits of the measure according to members of the committee. Is there any discussion? Senator Prasansky.
Was there any question as to why judiciary versus rules?
No. We are here on Senate Judiciary to serve. And that is
and
what we're
what
doing,
today. With the gavel, you'll be
it may be that rules isn't meeting.
I think it's the regularity of this committee's meetings as opposed to rules.
Okay.
That's a very good theory, Senator Cruz. Okay. Any other discussion, objections?
Since so I have a similar resolution, this is just
okay. Fun. It's introduced. Okay. Now, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 323. Do we have our counsel on board? We do.
Senate Bill 323. Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 323 relates to statements by a defendant during custodial interrogations. Criminal prosecutions often involve evidence consisting of a defendant's statements to officers. Such statements can arise in a myriad of locations, at the scene, in a police car, at the station, etc. Sometimes these statements are recorded electronically, but such recording is not required for the statements to be used in court. Senate Bill 323 changes that rule in certain specific situations. It requires the recording of any, quote, custodial interrogation, close quote, of a defendant suspected of committing a felony if a recording device is available. Otherwise, subject to some exceptions, the statement is inadmissible in court against the defendant. Senate Bill 323 defines custodial interrogation as an interrogation that takes place in a sheriff's office, a police station, a courthouse, a detention facility, a state, regional, or local correctional facility, or in any place where an adequate recording device is available. There are also several rules relating to the proper recording of a custodial interrogation. Even if the interrogation is recorded, it is still inadmissible unless each of the following occurs. One, the entire interrogation is recorded. Two, the defendant is advised of and waives his rights on the record. Three, the recording device worked and was operated by a qualified person. Four, the recording is unaltered. Five, all material voices on the recording are identified. And then six, the defendant was provided with a copy of the recording within a set period of time. There are also exceptions to the inadmissibility requirement, the most significant of which is that a statement is not inadmissible if the defendant refuses to have the interrogation electronically recorded, and then that refusal is captured on tape. Finally, there's a specific provision that states that a defendant's statement made at a location without a recording device is nonetheless inadmissible if the officer selected the location for the interrogation for the purpose of avoiding the electronic recording requirements. There is a dash one amendment to Senate Bill 323, and what this dash one amendment does is it changes it narrows the location requirements for custodial interrogations. It limits the scope of the bill solely to stations, courthouses, detention facilities, or correctional facilities, and then it eliminates the language about anywhere an adequate recording device is available.
Okay.
Any question?
Senator
Krasinski. I just want a clarification before we start hearing from evidence or hearing from witnesses. On the dash one, counsel, I'm assuming what that is trying to do is not prohibit a discussion or interrogation that occurs out in the field in the sense that if someone is at the scene of a crime and they are having a conversation with this individual and they get information from them after Mirandize and all that, if they're that far along in the process, that they would not be, or the statements would not be inadmissible just because they're out in the field?
Senator Przanski, that's correct. That's my understanding. And without the Dash 1 amendment, my guess is that there would technically be an argument if an officer had any kind of recording device on him or her in the field and got a statement from a defendant, well, the recording device was available, could have used it, it would be inadmissible. With the Dash 1 amendment, that takes this out, that situation out. So it's only talking about these specific locations rather than anywhere. So the scenario that you came up would be outside the scope of 323.
And one other just clarification, besides being in the field, I would assume that if they were being transported in a police vehicle or some type of law enforcement vehicle back to one of these facilities that's in the Dash 1s, those statements also would be more than likely admissible under the Dash 1s.
Senator Przanski, yes, that's my understanding as well.
Say that again. Those statements would be admissible if they were...
If you're in the patrol car and the defendant was in the back and decided to start telling the story as they are going toward the station, I believe based on the Dash 1s, those statements would not be considered custodial interrogation as is defined under the Dash 1s, which
correct.
Would mean
they
would be
they would be admissible under the Dash 1s. That's how I thought I heard it. I just want to make sure I heard that correctly. Okay, Amy Alkanich.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amy Alkanich. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here in support of our Bill 323. There are quite a few changes that we'd like to have made, although we've only, at this point, submitted one amendment. And the goal of that amendment was to substantially narrow the scope of this bill. After having taken a look at it, we all felt that the way it was drafted would hinder police investigations or potentially hinder police investigations, as Senator Przanski pointed out, in the field, in a police car, in any other location. And the goal of this is certainly not to have that impact. So what we would be doing with the Dash 1 amendment is taking out Section B, essentially, which is a place not listed in subparagraph A if an adequate recording device is available. We believe that would only require that a recording occur at the places listed in the Dash 1 amendment in a courthouse detention facility, state, regional, local, correctional facility. We believe that just from the beginning
narrows the definition. Additionally, what we'd like to take out is that it be only in a felony investigation. And we've had an opportunity to speak with Brenda Wilson, who I think said she was going to submit testimony, although I haven't seen it, from the city of Eugene about some potential changes. And after speaking with her, we think it would be appropriate to remove the felony requirement. And on its face, that may seem like that would have a negative impact. But in my opinion, in the Oregon criminal defense lawyer's opinion, in Brenda's opinion, this would have a positive impact because it would not require the police up front to make a decision on whether or not an offense would be considered a felony or a misdemeanor. It's not the police's job, in our opinion, and it shouldn't be the police's job to make that determination. It should be the district attorney's job. So this would apply to any time somebody is being interrogated in a custodial situation at the station and not be narrowed to a felony situation. We also think that would have a positive impact on motions to suppress, because you would not have a defense attorney come forward and say, this should have been recorded, it's a felony, and have the officer have come and said, well, I thought it was a misdemeanor when I thought started. So we think that would add an additional level of protection for the police and the district attorney's office. I'd also like to go through some of the changes we've agreed to work with, like I said, Brenda Wilson, and are willing to work with any other interested party, although I suspect we probably won't come to a consensus with everyone on this bill. We have agreed to narrow the definition of custodial interrogation to match the current case law definition, which I don't have in front of me. The definition we have here is much broader than is currently in the case law. She brings up the issue of suspected of a crime. I think we talked about that a little when we removed the issue of the felony and the misdemeanor attachments and definition. We talked a little bit about recording equipment. Again, that's something where we want to be very clear that this only needs to happen when a recording device is accessible, and we don't expect an officer to have to obtain one when there is not one readily accessible. And we hope that that's clear in the bill, although if there are some concerns, again, we're willing to address those. Ms. Wilson had a concern about making sure that the refusal was electronically recorded. I think that part should be omitted from this bill. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And so I think that's something we'd like to remove from that, because if someone's not willing to talk on tape, they're probably not willing to offer their refusal on tape. So it seems to be a little bit of a conundrum to have it written in the bill that way. And there are some other ones about making sure that the officer is protected in exigent circumstances or circumstances where it would not be safe for an officer to go get a tape. And I think we can all kind of imagine what those emergent circumstances might be. So with those changes in mind, we would ask that you support Senate Bill 323. We believe that it offers a level of protection to the defendant as well as the police. And we hope that it would be a tool that both prosecutors and defense attorneys could use in negotiation and trial. So I thank you for your time, and I'd like to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a concern, and it's with Section 3, sub F, which is 9 through 12 on page 2, because we heard testimony when we were talking about court reporters that sometimes the electronic recordings of court proceedings can be messed up for a lot of reasons, and this basically talks about you have to have clear and convincing evidence that there was a failure of the machinery. And I mean, I guess I'm just kind of looking at the one and then looking at this other, and it may not be failure of the machinery per se, but failure of people to understand mm-hmm. where microphones need to be and all this other stuff. A tape runs out and they didn't know that was going to happen, and they don't turn it over. So there are a lot of other, I would think, extenuating circumstances there that I don't think would fit under this exception.
Thank you, Senator Cruz, members of the committee. That is one of the issues that Brenda Wilson brought up as well. We've agreed to work on making sure that Section 3F is tightened up so it doesn't have that problem. Again, what we don't want to do is stand in the way of a police investigation, and because of that, you know, I respect that that's an issue in the way in this bill as it is now. So it is something that is a section we'd be willing to either completely take out or to work on tightening up.
Yeah, just to follow up, Madam Chair, I guess if we have trouble with electronic recordings in completely controlled environments, it brings it into question in environments that sometimes are not completely controlled.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll have Eric Wassman, Cortland Geyer, John Powell, and Brian DeLashmit. Come up. You just haul an extra chair if you want. I figure we'll take care of everybody at once here. I think Mr. Powell indicated some anxiety about maybe needing to leave early. Are you okay, John? Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. My name is Eric Wassman. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. I work in the Criminal Justice Division in the District Attorney's Assistance Section. For those of you who don't know me, I'm fairly familiar with one or two of you. Let me explain what our unit is about so that you'll get some perspective on my testimony. The District Attorney Assistance Section is tasked with assisting district attorney's offices throughout the state. We provide trial assistance at the invitation of local district attorneys. We also have special prosecution units in areas such as internet crimes against children, tobacco tax fraud, and additionally, we on occasion provide the service of acting as interim district attorneys if there is a vacancy in the elected office of the district attorney in a particular county. We serve that role uniquely this year, or the past 6 months, in three counties almost simultaneously. And I mention this because I think it, to some extent, informs you about the perspective I bring to this issue, which is that we see law enforcement and prosecution in all 36 counties in the state of Oregon, and I think we have a fair sense of the differences among law enforcement agencies, the training they have, and the resources that are available to them. Let me begin by saying that the Attorney General opposes Senate Bill 323 in concept. While there are many things that could be done to make this bill less objectionable to the Department of Justice, essentially at its core, we believe this bill is the wrong direction for the Legislative Assembly to go. But let me also say that as a prosecutor, no one likes a taped confession or admission by the criminal defendant more than I do. It is, when it's available, the most powerful evidence in the case, and we would always like to see it. But as prosecutors, we also understand that it is not practical to obtain that taped statement in every case. This bill falsely assumes that all criminal investigations proceed in a regular, orderly, and predictable manner, and that the conditions for tape recording are always in place and available. That is really not the case. Resources vary widely among the law enforcement agencies in this state, and you see that when you get into small counties with very small city police departments and very small sheriff's offices. Additionally, criminal investigations are fluid, dynamic. They sometimes happen at a rapid pace. Statements are taken from witnesses, suspects, and arrested defendants at odd times and in odd locations. I provided in my written testimony just really three examples of instances in which under the terms of the bill as drafted, and I think probably in terms of the bill as it has been suggested should be amended, that suppression would be likely to result in cases in which there's no showing that the statement of the defendant was unreliable or that it was recounted inaccurately by the officer. There was simply some technical flaw under Senate Bill 323 in the taking of the statement. We all flinch when we hear it reported in the public media that some person who's been charged with a serious crime got off on a technicality. And I'd suggest to you that that would likely be the public perception when the defendant's confession or admission in a particular criminal case was suppressed as evidence and kept away from the jury in any of the three instances I've cited. And Cortland Geyer is with me here from the Marion County District Attorney's Office. I think he has several more examples of the kinds of things that could happen in criminal cases that would result in the suppression of evidence. And this bill is about expanding the exclusionary rule, suppressing evidence, and keeping it away from the trier of fact in criminal cases. In many instances, the public would perceive that to be a frustration of justice and not justice. And I think that would be a very unfortunate outcome of this kind of legislative policy. Now, the proposal has been made to limit the bill and now confine its terms to interviews that occur in police stations and jails and basically facilities controlled by law enforcement agencies themselves. I will just say to this committee, however you try to tighten this up, there will be instances through human error, technical error, things we can't imagine today, in which the technical requirements of this bill would not be met and highly probative evidence would be suppressed and kept away from the jury. One thing we probably haven't thought about is, if this bill were to take effect, there would be a period of time during which law enforcement agencies would try to implement the bill, get the equipment, train their staff, and I can just guarantee you that in departments around this state, law enforcement officers would either not know they had this requirement or would forget in particular cases that they had it, and statements highly relevant would be lost. With respect to the amendment to confine the reach of this bill to police stations, the fact of the matter is, even if you limit the bill by its terms to that, in every instance in which an officer was out in the field without a tape recorder interviewing a suspect, a witness who might at some point become a suspect, or an arrested defendant, the officer would really have to calculate whether or not to engage in any questioning whatsoever at that time. Because under the terms of the bill, some court might later determine that the officer had, quote, selected the location for the interrogation for the purpose of avoiding the electronic recording requirements of the bill. So the officer has to weigh the risk of having the whole statement suppressed against the risk that if the officer waits or moves the interview to the police station, there might not be any statement made at all. So even with the proposed Dash 1 amendment, Senate Bill 323 will control police interviews of suspects, witnesses, and arrested defendants in all locations. According to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, there are over 5,000 certified police officers in the state of Oregon sworn to protect the public and to uphold the law. This bill would tell each of them that the Legislative Assembly did not trust them to accurately relate what they were told by the defendant in an interview. They would be told that their testimony on that subject would be suppressed and not given to the trier of fact. Attorney General believes that that's really the wrong message to send to these police officers and to the general public, and suggests that really would be better to let judges and juries continue to do what they have been doing for decades, which is to determine for themselves the reliability of the statements made, whether or not the statements were taken under voluntary circumstances, and what weight should be given to those statements. So the Attorney General asks you not to pass Senate Bill 323 to the floor.
Thank you very much. Your testimony was very comprehensive, so you're all on the same side, so if you could just limit your comments to new points and if there's any places where you disagree with Mr. Wassman, welcome.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cortland Geyer. I am a deputy district attorney over at the Marion County District Attorney's Office, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, which also opposes Senate Bill 323 in principle, as so eloquently put by my colleague here. But as I stated, I am day in and day out and have been for more than a decade a child abuse prosecutor. And I want to provide some additional examples of what I think passage of Senate Bill 323 would mean by bringing you into my world, as uncomfortable as it may be. You may remember just last week there was a large rally held on the steps of this building in support of Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month. A lot of numbers were thrown around, including the number that in 2005 in Oregon alone, there were over 11,000 confirmed cases of child abuse. There are many, many more cases that go unreported, and there's a number of blue ribbons on a tree down in front of the courthouse to symbolize all that. The dynamics of these cases is, in child sexual abuse in particular, you have a case when I'm presenting the proof to a jury where it is the word of the child versus the word of the adult. Word of the child versus the word of the adult, and we have to convince that jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed what he is charged with. And these defendants hardly look like the boogeyman at all. In more than 95% of the cases, the offender is someone who is known to the victim. That's how they get close to them. And while they probably don't have any arrests or convictions on their record, national statistics show that they have committed over 130 separate offenses by the time they are reported for what they've been doing a long time. Now, how do we prove all of those? The equalizer in all of this is statements by the defendant. Free flow of information. And first of all, in a number of cases, in the course of the investigation, statements made by the suspect turn out, in fact, to clear them of wrongdoing. So there's equal opportunity for this free flow of information. But then the statements frequently help us because far more frequently than one might guess, suspects in these cases either confess to what they're charged with or they make a denial that contains what we call provable lies. Now, under Senate Bill 323, under the world of Senate Bill 323, and in the world of reality TV, it may be hard to believe that there is a chilling effect when you put a tape recorder in someone's face. But this is what I have seen from cases that I have done, and this is what I've picked up anecdotally throughout the years. And if you think about it just in general, all of you have high-profile jobs. You've probably had to talk to the media at some point in time. There is an effect that goes over you when a microphone is thrust into your face. I know you all skillfully handle that, but there is this internal process you go through before you proceed to engage your mouth and speak. Now imagine that the microphone is thrust in your face and you are someone that has committed a serious felony and is under investigation for it. From everything that I have seen and heard over my career, I have no doubt that there would be a significant chilling effect in the amount of information that we get from people who are questioned in these cases. I wanted to just bring up a couple of quick examples from cases that I've done. This last fall, I tried a gentleman who in the end was convicted of smothering to death his girlfriend's 2-year-old son. Contact was made with him outside of a local pizza parlor, and because the police did not have enough to arrest at that time, very preliminary investigation, he actually sat in the police car. They did have a tape recorder on them at that time, and he said he would talk to them but refused to be taped. This was evidence to me of the fact that there is this chilling effect of the tape recorder, and I agree with I'm sorry, name escapes me, good woman who was here before testifying in, on behalf of Senate Bill 323, that then trying to capture that denial on tape would be fruitless, and I think in this case would have only frozen any statement that we got from him at all. In the end, We got a conviction on a very tough case because it was evident with that piece of that field interview of the defendant, even though he denied, that the police left no stone unturned. In the world of Senate Bill 323, they would never have heard of that contact with the defendant. And I think the jury always would have wondered why no one ever asked him about it, because with the right to remain silent, that's not something that the jury would get to hear about. Another case...
Mr. Geyer, can you
yes.
kind of wrap it up?
I'm sorry. I will cut the examples only to build on what Senator Cruz remarked upon. I have seen cases where digital confessions that were recorded have been lost. Unlike the tape, where you see that it's going and there's some physical evidence that you could look at to know that you're picking up what's being had, we do have people who maybe aren't very good at computers, and I have seen child sexual abuse cases where the confession thought to have been captured on digital recording was lost. Still, in those cases, we were able to present testimony of the confession, and the defense was able to challenge the validity of it because that was lost. Just my closing remarks. I know we all want to go home at night and feel like we've done something good for kids today. Based on my experience, I don't believe the passage of this Senate bill will help or protect children or be good for the overall administration of justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Powell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and just two quick points. One, we oppose Senate Bill 323 for the reasons the previous two witnesses have stated. And secondly, given what they do for a living, I want to put on the record I've never met them.
Okay. That's good. I'm glad you cleared up the record. You get the prize for the shortest testimony. Mr. DeLashmet, can you beat that?
I may be able to beat that. Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, what they said.
Okay. Got it. Okay. I think you win the prize. All right. Anybody else want to testify on this? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. And we'll open a hearing. I'm going to do
286.
Which one do you want to do next? Do
Chopping
Act is the 286. Yeah. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 286. Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 286 relates to a crime of child neglect in the third degree. ORS 163.545 creates the Class A misdemeanor of child neglect in the second degree, and ORS 163.547 creates the Class B felony of child neglect in the first degree. Second-degree child neglect relates to children under 10 left unattended for such period of time as may be likely to endanger the health or welfare of the child. First-degree child neglect relates generally to children under 16 in drug houses or premises deemed to be unfit for use under Oregon law. Senate Bill 286 creates a new category, child neglect in the third degree, which would be a Class B violation, which is generally punishable by a fine of up to $360, for persons who leave children under age 10 unattended in vehicles. Specifically, the elements of this offense are as follows. 1, person has custody or control of the child. 2, the child is under age 10. 3, the person knowingly or intentionally leaves the child in a vehicle. 4, there is no one 10 or older in the vehicle with the child. And then either one of the following two, the person does not have a direct view of the child, or the person is more than 50 yards from the vehicle. The offense of child neglect in the third degree becomes a Class B misdemeanor rather than a Class B violation if the person has a prior child neglect conviction.
Okay, Mr. Neely, this is your big chance. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my big chance. I'll take all the advantage I can. I appreciate you taking the opportunity to hear this bill. For the record, my name's Kevin Neely. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon's District Attorney Association. Senate Bill 286 fills a gap that we perceive in the law. I know that you're all probably thinking I've done this with my own child. But the answer is you probably haven't done it with your own child to the point where a police officer showed up. At least I hope you haven't. And if you have, then the police officer didn't have anything to do when he got to your car or she got to your car, because there wasn't a crime that occurred or a violation that occurred in the past. What this bill will do is create a violation for those instances in which a child is left in the car for a sufficient amount of time for an officer to show up to actually issue the citation. I think that the district attorney would be very unlikely, or the law enforcement officer would be very unlikely to issue a citation if you were, in fact, just leaving the child in front of the car to run back into the house and get something. And, in fact, there are a couple of provisions in this bill that limit the scope of its application. Right now, the district attorney, in those situations where you do have a child that is left in the car for a significant amount of time, the district attorney has to make a decision about whether or not to move that case forward as a child endangerment, which is a Class A misdemeanor. So this will give district attorneys and law enforcement a new tool from that perspective. Finally, in the last piece of this bill, is that if, in fact, you do this a second time and an officer shows up and gives you or attempts to give you a second ticket, the district attorney can then treat that as a Class B misdemeanor. Again, I think under current law, the reason that this ought to stay in this bill is that in those instances where this happens twice, the only option for the DA right now is child endangerment, which is a Class A misdemeanor. So with that, I would tell you that we do believe this is an important bill for those instances in which children are left in the car. As you all know, you've heard the stories of instances in which very unpleasant things have happened. The car has been stolen with the child in it. The child has then had to go on either a high-speed chase or been missing, and also cases in which we've had dehydration, other things like that. The child gets locked in the car with the keys, all of those things. This bill is hopefully a mechanism by which we can avoid having that happen, particularly a second time. With that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Okay. You'd still want the bill even if you didn't have a higher penalty for a second offense. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. As I said earlier, I've talked to OCDLA about this bill, and I'm happy to take out that piece that makes it actual crime to do it the second time. Again, I think the benefit of leaving it in there is that under the current law, if it happened a second time, there would be some likelihood that the district attorney would pursue, in fact, a higher seriousness of crime, and this would give them a tool to approach it with the Class B misdemeanor. But again, I'm happy to see that go if that's the motive of the committee or that's the desire of the committee.
Okay, any questions, Senator Cruz? You look troubled.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been troubled since January. actually, January of 97. But yeah. Mr. Neely, okay, let me run a scenario by you, and you tell me if I've committed a crime. Okay, I'm running around town. I have an infant in a car seat in the back seat. The infant's been cranky or hasn't been sleeping in, and fortunately the child has fallen asleep.
Yes.
Okay. I go to a store. It's not a hot day or anything, you know, and I get out of the car. I go into the store to run an errand, not wanting to wake this child up, and I'm gone for a few minutes, and I come back. According to this, I've broken the law.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think that's correct. You have broken the law, but also, again, if you go down I-5 at 70 miles an hour, you've also broken the law. And I think, again, here the key is the officers and district attorneys have to use discretion every day. And they do that when they see you speeding down the street, and I think they do that in these instances as well. Officer, I just ran into the store. My child's been having a hard time sleeping. I was gone for a second. The car was in view most of the time. It was only out of view for a second. I think the goal here is to try and fill a gap. We have to understand officers are using discretion every day, and that presumably that would be the case here. Now, if the officer sat there for 10 minutes while you were in Walmart, I think that, in fact, you should get a ticket. That's the view of the District Attorneys Association.
Senator Walker.
Well, I would agree with that, Madam Chair, but Senator Cruz's point is well taken. My daughter was colicky. Oh, boy, was she colicky. She wouldn't go to sleep. So I'd run the vacuum, and she'd go to sleep, and then you'd turn it off, and she'd wake up. So you take her for a ride in the car, and oh my gosh, she'd go to sleep. So you'd drive into the garage, and she'd be asleep, and you could have a moment to take your eyes off the child, go in the house, leave the garage door open, the car's in the garage, but she's in the car unattended, but she's sleeping. and I got to sleep for a few minutes, and then she'd wake up, and I'd get her, and we'd go through it all over again. So that's discretion. How would an officer know my child was in my garage and we'd just driven for an hour to get her to go to sleep? She's a much better child today at 27, I can tell you that.
Not colicky anymore?
No, though I do tell her these wild stories. Oh, gosh, she wouldn't stop crying. Anyway, that's discretion. And Senator Cruz's example is discretion. Now let's get to the examples that are horrendous, where they leave a child unattended and go into Walmart. Hopefully they're not shopping in Walmart, but they go into a major shopping store. And that child is left alone, unattended. It could be a hot day. It could be anything. So I understand what you're trying to get at here, and I'm just a little conflicted. Do we do the same thing for animals?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I'm not sure.
Well, it's a relating clause.
Well, I looked at that. It's relating to leaving a child unattended in a motor vehicle. You guys are pretty smart narrowing that relating clause. But my question would be, I know that some people leave animals, dogs, in their car, and dogs die in situations like that. And if we had a law about dogs, we could certainly have a law about kids or vice versa. So yeah. I'd like to know about that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I think that's a reasonable question. And I would add, I think in those instances where it's a really hot day and you leave the child unattended in the car, that in fact, child endangerment may well be the right thing to charge in those cases.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is more a effort to find, and don't think that there aren't a lot of these cases. I can tell you that I kind of told the District Attorney's Association when we were going over this bill that I would have, that I thought we'd probably hear the very things that we're hearing today, which is, hey, I do this all the time. And I can tell you that the District Attorneys see cases like this all the time where it's not a situation that the child is inherently at risk. So proving endangerment is going to be difficult, but the child, infant in most instances, has been sitting in the car unattended for 20 or 30 minutes while the babysitter or the parent went in and did a whole bunch of errands. And that, frankly, is inappropriate and ought to be punished with, at a minimum, a citation. And that's what this bill seeks to do. And so I hope that provides you a little clarity of the goals here.
Well, it does. But the age of 10, Madam Chair, that's an old child. We're using infant examples here. And my kids, when they were age 10, could sit in the car while I run into Dairy Mart. They're not going to do anything.
That you knew of.
Yeah, I knew of. Yeah, I mean, you've heard of situations where kids hit the gear shift and the car goes rolling along, but 10 is pretty old.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, again, you've heard of situations where the kid sits in the car and hits the gear shift. I think that's the situation that we're trying to address here. As I said, we trust law enforcement officers to have the right discretion all the time. And I think that we're looking for those areas in which the officer gets there, knows there's a problem, can see there's a problem. The kid hit the gear, or the kid hit the brake, the car has rolled down the hill, and there's nothing to do. So
I worry about those DAs and their Measure 11s.
Okay, this bill. Okay, moving right along. Any other questions, comments? Thank you. Anybody else in the audience who's had a sudden urge to testify on this out of guilt or concern? Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 286 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 435.
All right. What's the bill?
Thank you, Chair Brody.
Sorry.
Chair Brody and members of the committee, Senate Bill 435 relates to telecommunications. Present ORS Chapter 759 relates to telecommunications utility regulations. What Senate Bill 435 does is it prohibits persons who provide telecommunications services, and that is a term that is specifically defined at ORS 759.0052G. It prohibits persons who provide telecommunications services in Oregon from charging Oregon police or Oregon prosecutors for tracing calls if the request for a trace relates to a criminal investigation. And my understanding is that there are occasions where about $150 a request might be the charge.
Welcome, Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, Floyd Przonski, State Senator, District 4. In my day job as a prosecutor for various cities, I work with the Florence Police Department. I'm going to give you a scenario. I don't have the case report in front of me, but we had an individual that called in bomb threats to the community of Florence at two different locations, one of them being a school. It was determined that the person that was who called in the threats had been using a cell phone. The police department attempted to make access to the number of the cell phone, which was recorded through the process of the dispatch center, and they basically had to go through a process of going through the telephone providers, telecommunication service providers, to try to get this information. Lo and behold, as they were going through this investigation and attempting to complete it's not necessarily a trace, but trying to get the identification of the person who owned that cell phone, they ran into problems. They then started to seek that information through during their investigation, I believe using subpoenas, only to learn that for them to get access to that information, they were going to be charged. And my understanding, it was $150 per charge for each of the inquiries. This is the situation that I was surprised and taken back when the department brought it to my attention, and there was some discussion as to why would law enforcement in the middle of a criminal investigation, and one in this case where you have bomb threats that have been called in, would be required to go through a process that would require them to be charged for the service of getting this information to try to carry out their duties of public safety. I told the department that I would raise that concern. They asked that legislation be filed, and that's what Senate Bill 435 is before us for. I will tell you that the provider in this particular case was Quest. Their lobbyist, Jenny Lang, and myself have had a discussion. She has been gracious enough to walk me through the process and get information from the various contractors or people that actually were involved in the network of getting this information. I understand that there are expenses, but one I would question as to when there's a legitimate criminal investigation going on. And I would say if we're looking at needing to, let's say, narrow the scope of this bill, when you have one that's in such an emergency situation of a bomb threat, even though the threat may have passed, this individual actually ended up calling at least two, if not three, threats into the city. That it was important and imperative to get that information as quickly as possible and not being held up on paying some type of financial obligation to actually be able to contact that person and take the action that was necessary to protect not only this community but any other community that this individual may carry out those type of threats, and at that point not knowing whether they were legitimate to the point of where they would carry out the act. That's the purpose of the bill.
Okay. Senator Przonski, can you see any middle ground here, for example, some kind of limitation on the charges or the ability to pay the charges later, in other words, without just getting this information absolutely free?
I do, and that's why I said that we're looking at narrowing it. I think there's a question that we have to have for public policy and understanding that that we're talking about businesses for profit that are attempting to make money in providing whatever services they provide. But at the same time, I think there's a need for a common good for the state or for the community as a whole, and either there needs to be a reduced cost or they need or no cost. I believe $150 a shot adds up very quickly for any community that's attempting to carry out its public safety portion. I think the other way that this could be dealt with is maybe having a list of types of charges or investigations that are ongoing and limiting it to that arena or a combination thereof. But yes, I'm more than willing to try to reach, quote unquote, some type of middle ground if the chair and the committee would like that to happen.
Thank you, Senator Przonski. Any other questions?
Yeah, I do.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Madam Chair, there's a letter here from the City of Eugene, and Senator Przonski has probably seen it.
I have not.
It's from Brenda Wilson. They strongly support the bill. In the second paragraph, she says, in large or complex investigations, the bills from telecommunications companies for tracing calls can be very high, sometimes thousands of dollars. I'd like to know how a cell phone company could charge thousands of dollars for a larger complex investigation. I mean, is there an example? Can you give me an example from the city of Eugene or Florence?
No, Madam Chair.
He did.
And Senator Walker, I think what that more than likely means is when you have a complex case, one that's ongoing, you have numerous inquiries that are being made, each one, at least from the city of Florence's perspective and experience, is $150. And so if you have multiple numbers, and especially in large high-profile cases, it could be drug trafficking, where you have numerous types of phone numbers that are needing to be traced, ongoing investigation over a period of time, it can add up pretty quick.
Okay. And it sure doesn't cost the telecommunications company $150 each time to trace it, but there must be some.
Well, we're about to find out.
Bet they're testifying.
Yeah, and Jenny Lang is here, and she shared some of the information. I know that they do some contracting for different people or different corporations to provide certain types of services. So I would just assume in the course of business there is added fees as you go through the different layers.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you.
You may rejoin the committee now. Okay, Jenny Lang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest, and I'm also speaking in behalf of the Oregon Telecommunications Association today. Mr. Brant Wolf, who is the executive director of OTA, could not be here today, but shares our concerns about Senate Bill 435. Quest and other telecommunications companies do charge for what are called automated message accounting, or AMA, records, because the costs incurred for producing these records and under governing federal law, which I've cited later in my testimony, Quest is expressly authorized to seek cost reimbursement. At the same time, because we recognize the emergency and often sensitive nature of the situations, such as Senator Brzezinski mentioned, we routinely make the information available as quickly as we can and worry about how the costs are going to be paid for at later dates. So it is not a matter of holding anybody up from a law enforcement standpoint until we have a check in hand. The two main points that I'd like to make today are that when you get a telephone bill from us for your local service, you don't see a list of every local call that you make as you do when you look at a long-distance bill, where you see what location you've called, what time of day you've made the call, how long the call was, and so on. For flat-rate local service, we just charge you a certain amount of money and you make as many calls as you like. Because of that, the call detail is not generated in the normal course of our business, and we have to actually run one of these searches in order to determine whether we can even find the specific call that is being needed for the law enforcement agency.
No, wait, this is for cell phones. You do get an itemization, so you're talking about landlines here.
This is landline service only, yes. And in certain cases, for example, we may have records and they may be more easily retrievable if the call was created where facilities are either being tested by Quest personnel or other telecommunication services personnel, or if the call is terminated or originated at locations where a CLEC, a competitive local exchange provider, or a wireless carrier is providing some of the infrastructure. So I don't have all the information about exactly how a wireless carrier tracks this information. I can only speak to the wireline carriers. The cost of $150, which is what we currently charge, is based on a per day, the number of days and the number of telephone numbers searched. our costs actually exceed that, but that seems to be a reasonable amount of money and at least covers a portion of the cost that we bear. The second point that I would like to cover is that federal law does provide Qwest and other telecommunications companies the ability to charge for these AMA searches in the production of data in response to a subpoena, warrant, court order, or with the customer's consent. And the information in my testimony outlines the pertinent part of the federal law that grants that that opportunity. So given that, I would be happy to try to respond to whatever questions you might have.
Okay, now the federal law is permissive as to you recovering your costs, is that correct? Or is it mandatory that you do it under federal law?
It is not, well, it's designed to be self-executing. So I not being a lawyer, I can't parse all of those words, but what our interpretation is as a company is that we are authorized to recover our costs, and this is the authorization that we use. And as I said, we try to respond by getting the data as quickly as we can and then issuing a statement or an invoice to cover the costs of the investigations.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Bill 435. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 694 and its amendment. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. Senate Bill 694 had a public hearing at Lewis and Clark Law School previously on March the 16th. It relates to the restrictive confinement of a pregnant pig. Senate Bill, I'll address the bill in the context of the Dash 2 amendment, which is the significant amendment for purposes of today's work session. What Senate Bill 694 with the Dash 2 amendment would do is it creates a Class A misdemeanor for the restrictive confinement of a pregnant pig if a person does each of the following elements. First of all, confines a pregnant pig. Secondly, for more than 12 hours in any 24-hour period. Third, in a manner that prevents the pregnant pig from either lying down and fully extending its limbs or turning around freely, which is defined as being able to turn in a complete circle without an impediment, including a tether, without touching any side of the enclosure. There are specific exceptions for a pregnant pig that is, one, being transported, two, part of a rodeo or state or county fair, three, being slaughtered, four, part of lawful research, five, being examined by a veterinarian, or six, a pig in the seven-day period before the pig gives birth. Senate Bill 694 offers definitions of the term pig and of turning around freely. It would apply to the confinement of pregnant pigs on or after January 1st, 2012.
Okay, we have Kelly Peterson in the audience. Kelly, you want to come up in case there are any questions? Committee, well, this bill initially included restricting in tight spaces veal calves as well. And since we don't have a veal industry in Oregon, I had that section deleted. And so this bill, as we have it now, just pertains to pigs. And the testimony we got at our hearing at Lewis and Clark indicated that at least the people who came to testify, the family pig farmers who came to testify, indicated that this bill, as it now stands, would not affect their operations because there are two ways pigs are confined. One is while they're pregnant. Those are the gestation. Please stop me if I blow it, Kelly. Gestation stalls, and then another sort of confinement when they're actually giving birth and for the period after they give birth. So, Kelly, help me out here.
Chair Burdick and committee members, that's right. I also at the hearing, I think the Dash 1, because the Dash 1 amendment.
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, Kelly Peterson with the Humane Society of the United States. And I know there was some confusion because pregnant wasn't added before the word pig. And so the original dash one just clarified that. So the farrowing crate, there's the exemption for 7 days before the breeding sow delivers, and then after it delivers, clearly it's not pregnant anymore. So it can be in the farrowing crate for as the long a period as they needed it to, and I think some had expressed that 30 days was something that is commonly done. And then, of course, we have to have that component still in, and then removes veal from it. So.
Senator Kostanski.
Two questions or points. I guess the first is that I don't have my notes from the previous testimony. I thought we had testimony, though, that talked about more than 7 days, that it was sometimes common practice for 10 days before or something in a greater length of time than 7 days. And I'd like to get that clarified if that's true. That's one. The next, I guess, would be looking at on line 19 of the dash twos. It talks about during an examination, operation, or test by a veterinarian, or during temporary treatment for veterinary purposes. I'm wondering if that is limiting that type of restriction to veterinarians actually providing the service, knowing that a lot of husbandry work is done on the farm by the individuals themselves. And I perhaps have some reluctance to see if this is interpreted to be limited for certified or professional providers of veterinarian service as compared to husbandry that would be done in the common aspect. And then the third, I guess not question but statement, I appreciate the clarification that once the sow, the mother, has given birth at that point, it would not be pregnant and would be able to still be confined in some type of pens. From what we heard from the testimony, that there's opportunities, unfortunately, where mothers pigs will basically just lay down and crush the piglets without, and that's one of the reasons they may limit their movement. I forget exactly what that testimony was. So,
Senator Pruszynski, and I'll let Kelly respond to this, but it seems to me that your concern about the normal animal husbandry versus the veterinarian would be covered by the provision. I mean, you can put them in the pens for up to 12 hours during a 24-hour period. And so it would seem to me that probably even veterinarians in most cases would fit into that exemption. So this would say that, you know, they couldn't be kept in there for more than 12 hours during any 24-hour period except for this period right before birth.
Correct. I did want to add, there is somebody in the audience who he was at the last hearing.
Yes, I recognize you. Yes, you came before. I'm so glad you came back. Would you please come in?
Madam Chair, I have my notes from the last hearing, and I was reading them, and the farrowing crates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The farrowing crates, you put the pig in there 7 days before birth and 21 to 30 days after.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Walt Burke. I live out east of Gresham and do raise pigs.
It's his testimony.
What our concern is the 7 days prior is a longer time than what we normally need. 3 days prior to giving birth would be sufficient for us to have the sow into the crate so she can become accustomed to her surroundings and stuff like that. Most of us, when we do put them in the crate, leave them in there. It just depends on the breeder and stuff like that. Myself, my sows are only in the crate 10 days after, then I move them to the floor to a bigger pen where the little ones have had a chance to get their sea legs underneath them, learn what mom is, and then it's safer for them to move them to the floor out of the crate. So at the meeting we had at Lewis and Clark, we were talking up to 30 days because some breeders do leave them in there up to 25, 30 days.
After birth.
After birth, mm-hmm. Yes. So, you know, it just depends on each individual breeder, how they
So what you're saying is that this bill would have no impact on you, and in the sense that it doesn't regulate at all the period after the sow gives birth.
It's just the prior to the 12 hours, you know, being in the crate 12 hours, having to take them out. That would become cumbersome to us, having to, you know, put the pig in for 12 hours, take her out, because we do not know exactly when she's going to, you know, have her babies or feral. And so, you know, if we take them out in the morning, say at 6 o'clock, 12 hours later, we got to bring them back in. Well, they can feral, I mean, we can check them, and 15 minutes later, they can have 4 or 5 pigs on the ground. So that's where the 3 days prior, you know, putting them in 3 days prior to having their babies and just leaving them in for...
Well, this allows 7 days prior.
Okay.
Would that meet your needs?
That would more than meet our needs. I think that's too extensive. I think that could be narrowed down to 3 days prior instead of 7 to allow less time in that farrowing crate.
Okay. Senator Pazanski?
Yeah, Madam Chair, based on what I'm hearing, I'll forget your name.
Walt Burke?
Yes.
Burke.
Thank you for coming. It's really appreciative for me, and I think for the other members, to hear you, you know, kind of remind us as to what the testimony is. Yeah, based on what I'm hearing, I understand that in your practice, as long as you could keep them in the cage 24 hours a day for at least 3 days prior to, that's fine. Understanding that 7 in your practice is going to be would be longer than you would do it. But other breeders, I would assume, would be able to work within that time frame.
Yes, I think they would be able to.
Okay, and then the last part is that the concern that I had is afterwards has already been addressed, because since this is a limitation on sows that are pregnant, once they have given birth, then they're no longer pregnant.
That's correct.
So at that point, you would be able to retain them in, as you're saying, for yourself up to 10 days. And then I understand some of the other breeders may want to go a little bit longer, but they would not be covered by this.
That's correct.
So the only other question I have is regarding any type of husbandry work that you would need to do with the sow that's pregnant. This 12 hours and any 24-hour period prior to going to that 7-day window, that would be sufficient for you to give shots or do anything that would need to be done?
Yes. Normally, when we give shot, the only time I know of confinement for pigs was either in the gestation stalls, which has been, I think you guys have taken that out. I think the committee's taken that out, because gestation stalls in the United States are coming to an end anyway, and that's the way the industry's going. We are ourselves policing ourselves and getting and phasing the gestation stalls out. Smithfield Foods, for example, is one of the big ones that they will no longer buy meat from anybody that's using gestation stalls in the next couple of years. So they're being phased out across the country. The only confinement I know of to happen to confine a pig is in the farrowing process. For vaccinations, other kind of work, you wouldn't have to confine them like that. Maybe you might in certain situations, but most of the time, a local anesthetic to put them down for a few minutes while you do perform whatever the veterinarian needs to do, I think would be, I have never seen them in all my years, I've never seen them put in that kind of a situation for veterinary work.
Okay. So I assume based on what you've heard, what we call the -2 amendments would provide, you would be comfortable as a breeder. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Burke, I really want to express my appreciation not only that you've come here twice, and I apologize for not getting in touch with you before, but also you've really educated us on some of the practices that we didn't understand. We didn't understand, I think, before this hearing, the difference between a gestation crate and a farrowing crate. So I appreciate that. Yeah. Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was reviewing Mr. Burke's testimony because I asked a lot of questions. I learned a lot that day. And he talked about the mama crushing the piglets, and so you don't lose... You lose about 1 per litter now because you use a farrowing crate. The other thing, though, that you said was that, because I wondered how soon you rebred them, after 3 weeks, you put the sow with the piglet, and then you wait 2 more weeks, and then you rebreed them. Did I get that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically, Madam Chair, Senator Waters. Basically, pigs farrow 2.5 to 2.7 times a year, which means they have their babies. We have, when the sows are weaned, they come back into their heat cycle 5 days after they're weaned. They're rebred back at that point, and then 115 days later, they give birth again. They have the 4 or 5 weeks that they're on the mom. We wean. 5 days later, we breed them back again. It's an ongoing production.
Wow. And you have a 10-sow herd from what my notes indicate, and you were past president of the Oregon Pork Producers, so we have really benefited from your knowledge.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Byer.
I'd like to clarify, you're not here speaking on behalf of the pork producers, correct?
No, I'm not. I'm speaking on myself, but the other pork producers that were at the other meeting, their feelings, the input I got from them, the input that I've gotten from the board, the Oregon Pork Producers Board, which I'm not a member of, I'm a member of, but I'm not a board member, their feelings are what has been stated here today. The, you know, 3 days prior, 30 days after. That is their consensus, is what they would like to see in this bill.
They would like to see, or what they could live with?
What they could live with.
And there is a difference.
Well, okay. They could live with the 3 days going into...
My point is, do they think a bill is necessary?
They don't think a bill is necessary.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. That's why I see where you're going with that.
All right.
You could be a lawyer, Senator Byer. You get pretty good at it.
Yeah, he's been on judiciary too long, I think.
Obviously, for passing these kind of bills, I've been here too long.
Okay. Senator Byer is not really fond of this bill, so Senator Przanski, would you care to move the dash two amendments?
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 694.
Senator Przanski has moved the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 694. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Przanski.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 694 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved Senate Bill 694 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair. Senator Byer made no such motion. The good senator to my left made it.
Are you kidding? It's just habit, it's Senator habit. Byer. My deepest apologies.
I'm giving my beard, but you know,
you've made no mystery of your feelings about this bill. Okay, Senator Przanski has moved the Senate Bill 694 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Well, I'm sure. I just think we had a really good discussion. We got a great education about pig farming, and I still want to take a tour of some farm out in Mount Angel.
Hershey,
I think.
Farm in Mount Angel.
Yeah, that's exactly what we were talking about. My sister lives out the direction anyway, but I think that'd be great. But your input has been really important. Whether you think the bill's necessary or not, at least we've made it more palatable to you. So thank you.
And I think it's also worthy of note that wouldn't you agree that if a big industrial hog operation tried to move into Oregon and use these practices, that this bill might actually help the small farmer?
I don't know whether it would help the small farmer having a big industrial hog operation move into the state of Oregon. That would never happen in the state of Oregon. Grain is too hard to come by in the state of Oregon. We have no packing plants here. All our pork has to be imported as it is. We're a deficit state, so most of the pork that we eat in the state come from the big farms back east. So
how did you get into the hog operation?
He has 10 of them.
Real quick, my wife and I had horses when we first met and got married. Bought 5 acres. One thing led to another. We decided to raise a pig to put in our own freezer. One pig led to two pigs led to three. At one point, we had 25 sows that we were raising market hogs off of. Decided, well, we had to cut down because we had kids. Cut down. They went through the 4-H FFA programs. My one son moved away to Illinois. My other son's still here running, helping me run the operation, and we're still doing it. 4-H leaders and helping 4-H kids, and it's just a second business.
and that's how it all happened.
Well, as frequently as they breed,
it's easy to see why you got up to 25.
So in your production and your sell for consumption, I'm assuming that you sell to local markets or to restaurants?
It's niche marketing. Most of my pigs this time of year go to the 4-H FFA kids. The ones that aren't of show quality, then we will raise Cinco de Mayo's coming up. Some of the smaller ones that are out of these litters now will go for meat for Cinco de Mayo to different organizations and stuff for their barbecues and stuff like that. Rest of them, yeah, we do have niche markets, restaurants, people wanting custom raised pork to put in their freezers, and it's just all niche marketing. But 99% of us in the state of Oregon is all the niche market that we find our own markets to market our animals in.
Senator Blair? Madam Chair, I obviously will be voting against this bill, and I think you can use all the scenarios there are, like putting lipstick on a pig and making a silk purse out of a sow's ear. This is a completely unnecessary piece of legislation. It's going to do nothing, and whereas the pig farmers, who there aren't very many of them, they can live with it, they certainly would rather not have it, and it's not going to. I just don't understand why it's even here.
Okay. Well, we're trying to difference of opinion. I can just imagine the floor debate.
And you're carrying.
I think we'll make sure that you have a cold that day, Senator Barnes. We'll try to manipulate the Could you take the roll?
Please excuse Senator Kozofsky. Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
No.
Chair Burns?
Aye. Okay.
I think the state police should be notified, but I may have been threatened right there.
That's all right. My lawyer has been cringing all week. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on our...
Carrying that puppy?
Oh, gosh.
That piglet?
Yes. I think actually we should make Senator Beyer carry it, but I'll carry that bill. Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 345 and change counsel. And welcome Senator Brzezinski back to the witness stand here. We'll let counsel summarize and then we'll start here.
Everybody left.
I only still got three.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 345 requires a judgment creditor who seeks a sale of real property under a writ of execution to provide the sheriff a list of all interests of record who hold a priority lien. It requires the sheriff to provide written notice of the time and place of the sale to all interests of record who hold a priority lien and to include in the notice the list of such persons.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 345 is at the request of a constituent, Ray Crump. Mr. Crump has provided us with written testimony. He unfortunately was not able to be here today. He had planned on being here, but business obligations required him to be in Portland this afternoon at the time of the hearing. This is a bill that I'm asking us to move forward and pass because it's basically notification, I think, for consumers that are engaged in buying property that's being offered through a judgment creditor sale. Specifically, when you look at the letter testimony that Mr. Crump has provided us in my dealings with him, he'd called me to explain his frustrations as to how the process worked for him. He goes into great detail, or some detail, I should say, within his letter. But basically, he was looking at auctions that were within the local newspaper after seeing the legal notice of a sheriff's auction coming up for a piece of property, I believe in Springfield. He went by the property on a couple of different times to check out the property, had some interest in it, and then decided that he was going to attend the auction and be ready to make bid on it because he thought that he was going to be able to make a profit by going through this process because it looked like there's a lot of equity in the property based on his review as well as based on what he understood to be the debt against the property. What he didn't realize is that the holder of the lien that was up for sale through the sheriff auction, first of all, was a second lien. It was not the primary lien. It was held by the Bank of America. What he also did not know is that the first lien, the major primary lien, was also held by the Bank of America. So Bank of America, in this particular case, had two liens against the property, a first and a second. They were at that point trying to sell the second, and gave no notice within their notice to the sheriff, who had to then place the ad and move forward with the sale as to any other indebtedness that is against the property. When he reached the location of the sale, the people that were there were approximately 20 in number. There appeared to be only two individuals, himself and another, who were there to actively bid on the property, and the representative from the sheriff's office that opened the auction, as well as an individual representing the bank. The sheriff opened the auction by giving the formal statement that one, the buyer beware, and alluded to that the property may have other debts against it. He then, meaning Mr. Crump, asked the officer and the individual who was the representative of the Bank of America to be more clear as to exactly what did they mean by other debt. No one would answer the questions. Instead, they went forward with this, with the sale. Once they started the sale, he and another individual started to bid against each other. First bid was from the bank itself, $30,000, which was the amount of the debt on the second. Then the individual that he was bidding against, they moved the bid from $30,000 and ended up at $48,000, moving through a process of where they were upping each other's bid by about $500 as they went through it. The individual that he was bidding against turned out to be a county employee who was sitting there and in good faith trying to buy the property, but she stopped. And after the property was sold at the sheriff's sale, she walked over to him and said that she had just been informed that the property actually had other debts to it of somewhere around $170,000. At that point, he realized that he wasn't sure what he just got into. What he just completed was basically, as he thought, being duped, because as he attempted to get information regarding other indebtedness that could be there, he was not able to get that information from the representative who was there for the bank at the time of the sale. Now, clearly, individuals that are, let's say, buyer beware in these type of situations, because if you don't know what you're doing, if it seems to be too good of a prospect, it probably is. And if he had been, let's say, better educated and trained and had the ability to go through title searches, etc., he probably on his own would have found out that the property was heavily indebted. There was an attempt on his part to try to get clarification on this, as I mentioned, at the time of the sale. They would not give him information. And my understanding, and it's not in his statement to the committee, but I believe when he first contacted me, that when he was doing his background research, he attempted to get some information, but no one would call him back or would give him any information. It wasn't until after the sale was completed did people come forward, and they gave him the name of an attorney or representative for the Bank of America that he could contact it after the sale to get the details. What he should have done, as he said in the letter, is probably just refuse to walk with the deputy over to the bank and pay the $48,000 that he had bid it on that property, and take his lumps at that point. Instead, he wasn't sure exactly what he was getting. He wasn't sure from the information he just got from the other bidder that the property was indebted as heavily as it was. So he went over and paid the money in as required, then received the information, and then at that point, when he contacted the representative after the sale, then they started talking about how much indebtedness was actually against the property. What Senate Bill 345 attempts to do is just give a little bit more information from the part of the seller, the judgment creditor, to the sheriff's office that is going to commence the sale, and require that the notice place in the notice that the different people who have priority liens against the property. This is just to give the person that's looking at these type of sales a little bit more information before they go into investing in many cases their life savings in an investment that they don't realize is heavily indebted. And I think that this is something that is reasonable to ask for the seller to list what which lien they're selling. In this case, when you have the Bank of America holding first the primary lien, first lien, as well as the second, it seems clearly they could at least list theirs. And I would assume that since they're going for a foreclosure, they would have the information of any other junior liens that may be there. And so this is more for giving information and making certain that people are aware where they may be, challenged educationally as to knowing how to get this information.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Senator Prezansky, I'm just wondering, your testimony, I think, is speaking of listing all liens, which I think is appropriate. They should all be listed, but I think, unless I'm reading it incorrectly, if you look on page 2, lines 4 and 5, it's only talking about the interest recorded on the property that have priority over the lien of the judgment creditor. So I would think, and it seems like, and I would agree with, the property, all liens on the property should be listed. But I think this bill is saying only the ones that have priority over the one that they're selling.
Okay. I did speak with Mr. Crump, and he was comfortable with as the bill was written. I agree. I think it would be a better course for whoever is pushing the lien forward that they have a duty to list all liens that they know of and that they have taken some due diligence in doing that. What I do disagree with what one of the things Mr. Crump also suggested on his page 2 of the testimony was to require the amount that was owed on each of those liens. As we, I think, all know, those amounts will change daily depending on the interest and all that. And to me, I'm not asking that this committee require a judgment creditor to list the actual dollar amounts, but I think all the liens should be. And I'm more than willing to get amendments drafted to make certain that is accomplished. Because I believe that in this particular case, let's say if it was the primary lien, the first lien that was listed at the amount that was, I think it was $100,000. I forget exactly how much was the first lien for. The first was $176,000 plus interest, and there are a couple others. If that was the first one, there'd still be junior liens in this case of $30,000.
Exactly.
Right.
But as drafted, I don't think the bill does that.
I'll be more than glad to review that. I apologize. I hadn't taken the time to look at it based on his review, and he thought that it took care of everything.
I'd like counsel to clarify, because I could be reading it wrong.
I think you're reading it correctly. It's just priority liens.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Aaron Bill and Jack Monroe.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Aaron Bell. I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar since 1987, and my office is in Canby. The primary focus of my practice is the representation of debtors, and creditors, primarily emphasis on creditor representation. I appreciate this opportunity to testify as a representative of the Oregon State Bar, a member of the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section Legislative Committee in opposition to Senate Bill 345. I'll try to be as succinct as I can in stating the heart of our opposition. The apparent purpose of Senate Bill 345 is to provide prospective purchasers of real estate at an execution sale with information that will enable them to bid more freely. However, the bill requires disclosure of recorded liens in the instructions to the sheriff. But there could be unrecorded senior liens, and up to 60 days may pass between the time that the instructions are provided by the creditor to the sheriff and the time of the sale. Consequently, prospective purchasers will need to assure themselves that no intervening liens have been recorded against the property between the time the instructions are provided and the time of the sale in any event. Furthermore, the absence of any penalty or effect of the disclosure by the creditor will create instability not only in the execution process, the finality of the sale, but the validity of the purchaser's title. And for those reasons specifically, the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section Legislative Committee opposes this bill and requests that you not pass. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
I'll wait.
Okay. Mr. Monroe.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe speaking today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. And you have a written statement prepared by Cleveland, Cleve Abbey, who is a vice president and counsel for Lawyers Title. And so today I'm really the conduit. As you'll note, it's a statement in opposition. I think he's done a nice job of going through and sort of succinctly stating the problems that we would see. Certainly, while the intent of the bill might be to provide clearer or better public disclosure, there's a lot of ambiguity given the language, some of which Mr. Bell has identified. There are, as he indicated, a range of interests that that range from monetary liens, such as a mortgage, through involuntary liens like tax liens, and then other interests that aren't monetary that are potentially out there. There are questions about liability if, in fact, this list turns out not to be accurate, and as Mr. Bell has pointed out, there might be a number of reasons why that might be the case, certainly because of the temporal considerations he talked about. It's also unclear what the remedy might be, whether there's a dollar sort of judgment here or rescission is one of the potential remedies. And the downstream consequence, I guess, of all of this uncertainty is, as Mr. Abbey has pointed out, is to create, ultimately to create uncertainty about the sale and whether or not it's a final sale. And I think, as he has concluded, given the uncertainty raised by what the interests are, what the liability might be, what the remedies are, ultimately it will adversely impact probably the interests of both debtors and creditors. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Pozowski.
Thank you. Mr. Bell, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. Jack, thank you for being here. I'm not sure if you want to entertain responding, that's fine as well. I'm wondering, I mean, to me, this is a disclosure, and it's something that it seems to me that we should be able to reach, let's say, some middle ground to make certain there's a little bit more disclosure. It seems like even in the sense of when the instructions goes to the, when they go to the sheriff's office, it could state as of something in the sense of giving some type of notice that as of this date, these are the liens that we know of. The other would be if you have recorded versus unrecorded, maybe some statement that of recorded versus unrecorded would be another way that to be able to distinguish. I'm also wondering at the time of the sale, if a lien has not been recorded, it's unrecorded, can the individual who has a lien that's unrecorded go against the new property owner after the sale? At the sheriff's cell,
there may be. I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Senator Przanski. There may be what are called inchoate liens, liens that are laying in the weeds that might not come to fruition, if you will, for a period of time, and may not be recorded during that period prior to the sale. Your title policy or an ALTA policy would cover you as a buyer in those circumstances. For example, there are certain agricultural service liens or agricultural provider liens that may be imposed on the property that don't necessarily need to be recorded for a certain period of time after the services are provided. Those are the kinds of unrecorded liens, tax liens again, for example. That could arise during that interim period that wouldn't necessarily be picked up or protect that buyer if they were included in the instructions.
Okay.
I agree with you that it is a notice provision, but in every circumstance where a buyer is acquiring a piece of property, the onus is on that buyer to protect themselves from any liens that are that encumber that property. Surely it's not the seller's obligation to protect the buyer's title interest. The seller is merely selling what the seller owns.
Okay. Well, if I have one follow-up. I want to go to the example I gave. Hopefully you heard the example of Mr. Crump when he's at the sale. There is a representative for the Bank of America who had both the first and the second. The second was being sold. A question was asked as to what other indebtedness was on the property. Isn't it only reasonable that when you have a holder of, in this case, the first and the second, standing there, to have an obligation to disclose as to their other interest in the property, instead of just being, let's say, quiet and waiting in the weeds until after the bidding takes place and then inform them? It seems to me like that's a little bit on their side of being, not good business practice. And I will say that Bank of America did actually do at least part of the right thing as to allowing them out of the sale, but he still had to pay $8,000 to go through the process of re-noticing all this. But I'd like your opinion as an attorney of the state bar, whether you think that a holder of multiple interest, when asked a question at the time of the sale, has a duty to disclose.
I'm, Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, I don't mean to punt by my answer, but I think that there is a difference between a legal duty and perhaps an ethical duty. And not knowing who was there at the sale, the circumstances, and so on, I can't really attest to the ethical duty. With regard to the legal duty, the notice discloses what interest is being sold. The notice is published in a publication of general circulation in the county for 4 successive weeks prior to the sale. And in fact, in most instances, if the seller is following the procedure and the sheriff is following the procedure set forth in the civil process manual that's used by most sheriff offices throughout the state of Oregon, they will conclude that publication at least a week prior to the sale. So anyone who has picked up this publication notice of the impending sale will have had plenty of time to seek sources to find out what encumbrances or impediments might be against that property. No, the lender doesn't have a legal obligation to disclose. Do they have an ethical obligation? Perhaps, particularly if you know that the buyer is one unsophisticated, that the buyer hasn't conducted their own due diligence, or that the buyer is relying upon someone else's representation, worse if it's your own representation, that they are buying a first interest.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, comments? Can you see a middle ground on this bill where you could have more disclosure but stay out of some of the pitfalls that you have identified in your testimony, either of you?
It might not be a middle ground. It perhaps is more shifted towards the creditor's ground than the buyer's ground. But I'm not authorized by my committee to testify to this. It's just my own personal observation, Madam Chairman, and that is that if perhaps the instructions directed the sheriff to include in the notice that there is an obligation on the buyer to undertake their own due diligence to determine what liens or encumbrances may exist against the property, that could or would be sufficient. Then in that instance, the buyer could not or should not be relying upon anyone to assure their title.
Okay. Thank you for the suggestion. I've got a couple others, though. Thanks.
Okay. to be continued.
Madam Chair, I did notice in the letter from Mr. Crump, he indicated that a title search is between $300 and $400. Which is a significant sum of money, but you're also looking at investing a significant sum of money.
Yeah, and that's true, and I think it was quite interesting also in this letter. The Bank of America position was what they did was legal. They never said it was right, only that it was legal.
Right. I did read that, too.
Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
I might comment for the record, Jack Monroe, again, that figure for what would be called a preliminary title report seems to be significantly inflated.
Well, that gets to my question.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask Mr. Monroe, and you might not be able to answer, but would Mr. Crump in this case been able to take that legal description to a title company and ask for a title report on the property?
Absolutely. You know, I guess to add to the response, I mean, I think, you know, as Mr. Bell has indicated, the buyer in these instances certainly has obligations, whether we're talking about purchasing something at a foreclosure sale or buying a used car or whatever. And for a purchaser to not have done sort of a routine due diligence, one can certainly end up with buyer's remorse.
Okay. Thank you. Close public hearing. We are adjourned.